to Up My Nursing Game, the educational nursing podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. I am your host, Annie Fulton. Listeners of this podcast can claim free CE credits for each episode through VCU Health. See the link in the show notes or at upmynursinggame.com. Today's episode is about nutrition and is an adaptation of a breakout session I attended at the NTI conference last May. The speaker, Jan Powers, is here today to give us an overview of what nurses need to know about nutrition in hospitalized patients. This episode is chock full of actionable takeaways and myth busting that is sure to influence your practice. You may catch that Janice and I said that we were going to talk about refeeding syndrome, but we never did. So instead, I will be releasing a short video about refeeding syndrome over on Facebook and Instagram, which I encourage you to follow if you'd like to be served more educational content in your social media feeds. I have to admit something to you guys. I'm going to be really honest here. So here it goes. At the beginning of COVID, I stopped using stethoscopes. We use crappy disposable stethoscopes in COVID rooms, which I found just about impossible to hear from over the din of negative air pressure machines. And for non-COVID patients, I was so concerned about my stethoscope being a vector for virus transmission that I just stopped using my stethoscope. However, last year, I put on my big girl pants and I bought a 3M Littmann Core with Echo technology, and I was like, this is the stethoscope I've been missing. Between noise canceling and 40x sound amplification, my patient assessments markedly improved. I've entered a partnership with Echo to bring you $50 off your order. So check out their website, echohealth.com, ekohealth.com, and use the promo code GAME to get $50 off your order, and know that you have a 75-day risk-free trial if you're not convinced it's the world's most advanced stethoscope. So today we have Jan Powers, and she is the Director of Nursing Research and Professional Practice at Parkview Health System. She's also an adjunct professor at Indiana University School of Nursing. And Jan has been a nurse for 35 years in various roles related to critical care and trauma, primarily focused on implementation of research and evidence-based practices to improve patient outcomes. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you so much, Annie. It's great to be here. I'm really honored to be on the podcast today.
I met Jan when she gave this great talk at NTI in May about nutrition. I'm kind of interested to hear how you got interested in nutrition, given your background in critical care and trauma. What about your experience kind of led you to focus on not just nutrition as one of your focuses, but one of your main focuses in your career?
Yeah. So it's really interesting. As you said, I've been a nurse for over 35 years now. And, you know, way back when I started nursing, nutrition was really not a focus at all. And, you know, I can think back and see patients that would just be in the ICU and, you know, we might not feed them for 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. And it was always an afterthought. And then I was in a position as a clinical nurse specialist. And so one of the things that we primarily focus on is bringing evidence into practice. How do we improve our patient outcomes? And what we noticed in our ICU was exactly that. We were not feeding our patients. And then when we were feeding them, trying to get that started earlier, there was quite the delay in getting feeding tubes placed. And they would have to go down to radiology. And, you know, if it was a Friday, then they would wait over the weekend. And again, we're at 4 or 5 days not feeding the patient. So we really investigated different ways to get our patients fed earlier. And that kind of just sparked this fire. And I've just been so intrigued, I guess, at the positive aspects of nutrition. And then also really looking at the opposite, that a lot of nurses aren't aware of the importance of nutrition and the absolute essential role that they play in facilitating adequate nutrition for our patients.
So earlier in your career, when you kind of argued that we were not focusing on nutrition, were there dietitians in the hospital setting?
There were, not as active as they are now. Dietitians would pretty much, you know, wait for their order to come and then they would, you know, come see the patient. But if the physicians weren't putting in those orders, they weren't seeing the patients in a timely manner, you know. And now we have, fortunately, I think, you know, a lot of outside agencies like Joint Commission saying we need to do a nutritional assessment within 24 hours. And I think that has really spawned a lot more aggressive nutrition support focus for our patients.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume that consult to dietary is now part of like an order set for a patient who is admitted to the ICU, or especially like a trauma patient.
Yes, yes. And it is automatic. I think most hospitals, I believe, have dietitians where they even operate under their own protocols per se, so that they know, you know, they're looking. We have an ICU dietitian and she looks at all of the patients and is making recommendations even before, you know, there's a consult placed. And then the other flip side of that, for all patients coming in, you know, we need to have a nutritional risk screening, malnutrition risk screening, complete it within 24 hours. And a lot of places, you know, with our electronic health records now, it automatically generates a dietitian consult, which is fabulous. So definitely that early involvement is great.
Yeah. And at least the hospital where I work, dietitians round during, yeah, you know, grand rounds in the ICU. And so it's good to see them, you know, like front and center, really like becoming like an integral part of the team.
Yes. Yes. I mean, very, very essential part of the team. You know, and I also just want to say, though, you know, I think there's nurses that do believe, well, the dietitian's there, they're going to see the patient, they're going to make recommendations, I don't need to worry about anything. And so that, you know, in looking at this, it's not just the dietitian that owns nutrition. It is the entire healthcare team that owns this and needs to be focused on this. And I have found when nurses really understand the importance of nutritional support, and especially early enteral nutrition in the ICU, they are the advocates and they're, you know, the ones saying, hey, we need to get something started here if it hasn't been.
Let's dig into that more. Let's talk about why nutrition is important here. So before kind of jumping into the whole nutrition part of it, can we talk a little bit about like what feeding a patient does to the gut?
Yes. And I think, you know, even to flip that and say, what does not feeding a patient do to the gut is absolutely important to talk about. And you're right. I think people just think, okay, well, you know, it's like, you know, we eat our two or three meals a day and, you know, that's fine. And we get all our nutrients. But in the ICU, and actually any patient that comes into the hospital, you know, a lot of them are already malnourished, you know, or they're developed malnutrition while they're under our care. But also it's about the gut integrity. And so when you have critical illness or some type of injury, trauma, you know, what is it? You have the inflammatory response. And that is happening in the gut as well. You know, so you have hyperpermeability, you have, you know, I don't think people realize how many trillions. I just read a citation, I think it was 40 trillion microorganisms live in our gut.
Wow.
And so you think about, you know, and there's really good bacteria, right, that we want that, and they're playing a great role, you know, but if you have this permeability, then your gut gets leaky and they, you know, go out into other areas of the body. You know, we used to call it bacterial translocation, but now we really look at the whole microbiome, you know, and there's a lot of research just really taking off in this field. So not a lot I can really speak to about that other than it's like, wow, this is a huge problem. But the inflammation, cytokine release, you know, all happens in the gut as well, and you're getting edema. But I think one of the biggest things that people overlook is the role that the gut plays in the immune function. And so 70% of our immune system, you know, that is functioning to prevent infections and keep our body safe is located in the gut. It's very rich in lymphocytes, and then it works with the macrophages and helps. It's just a natural barrier, and it's stimulating our whole immune system in the gut. So we don't want that to go away. And if we're not feeding the gut, it's going to start having apoptosis and atrophy, and certainly not working as well, and let alone the absorptive functions of the gut. So you have millions of little villi lining mm-hmm. your mucosal system in the gut, right, in the intestines, and that is what absorbs, and that's what plays a good role in the immune system functioning as well. So if those start to atrophy from lack of feeding, then it's not going to work as it should.
So you're saying that if we decrease the amount of time that a patient's malnourished, that will make them more effective at absorbing the nutrients they need when we do start refeeding them.
Right.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understand this bacteria translocation. Was that what you called it? Mm-hmm. So the bacteria translocation that occurs during this, you know, inflammatory state. Are you saying that, you know, bacteria from the gut, you know, all these trillions of bacteria that we have get translocated into the blood? Where is it going?
So possibly, and that was a theory about 20 years ago, but there's still some thought with this permeability of the gut that this bacteria then, yes, gets into the bloodstream, can cause infections into other organs. I think the science has progressed some since then, and looking at the whole functioning, you know, with 40 trillion microorganisms, it's hard to say, well, this one is what's causing this problem. But, and truly, we don't have a lot of the answers right now. You know, people are looking at, do we use probiotics or prebiotics, you know, to help maintain that gut functioning, just like, you know, people that are out of the ICU or out of the hospital would do to help maintain that integrity and the microorganisms.
Got it. Okay. So the thought is that during this state of inflammation, that bacteria from the gut could be translocated to a different area of the body, causing a secondary infection.
Yes.
Cool. I did not know that. Let's talk about wound healing, or not necessarily healing, but talk about like the energy aspect of nutrition and why our patients need it.
Yeah. So, and I did want to, go back and just tap on the time frame that you had talked about originally, because that's why it is so essential as we're looking at feeding our patients that we focus on trying to get them fed within 24 to 48 hours. I mean, every guideline that you look at will say within 48 hours, and some are moving to within 24 hours for that exact reason, that we don't want that atrophy of the villi. We don't want the integrity of the gut to, you know, be affected by the lack of feeding. So even if you can't feed a patient fully to their goal, you know, that's why you will hear people saying, you know, should we use trickle feeds or trophic feeding, you know, which is just a very low rate. So you're still feeding the gut to maintain those protective mechanisms without causing any adverse problems from the lack of feeding.
Okay. So it sounds like the reasoning behind trophic feeding is not calories. Right. It's just to maintain that gut integrity and to prevent this inflammatory response.
Okay. Exactly. That's exactly right. And of course, we want the calories, and, you know, to get into all the positive aspects of why we need calories and specifically protein with our patients. But, you know, if we cannot get them up to their goal for whatever reason, probably the most common is, you know, they're on vasopressors, or, you know, some people will look at proning. Maybe we can't feed them fully, although I will dispel that. I think we mm-hmm. can. But, you know, for whatever reason, it's not just don't not feed them, give them something to protect the gut, even if we can't give them the calories that they need.
Okay. When you're talking about trophic feeding, like, can you give an example of a rate at which you're giving patients feeding?
We would usually do maybe 10 milliliters an hour, maybe up to 20 milliliters an hour, but not, you know, you're not getting up to your 40, 50, 60 cc's an hour.
Got it. Okay. And this is just with your standard tube feedings?
Yep. Just what you would feed normally, but just a very low rate. And basically it has that gut protective mechanism.
So we've talked about gut integrity and the risk of infection from translocation, bacteria translocation. What else are, you know, some of the negative impacts of malnutrition?
Yeah. So getting into, if you think about just any patient, so the immune function, let's go with that. You know, so, mm-hmm. so this is helping our immune system and helping decrease infections. So our patients obviously are at a great risk for infection. There's a lot of research that has shown malnutrition results in increase infectious complications, you know, and, you know, this is probably a big reason why. It also contributes to pressure injuries or decreased wound healing, you know, especially when you're not getting the calories and the protein and the other nutrients from the tube feedings, you know, that's a huge problem. As well as, you know, there's malnutrition causes, it doesn't really cause, you can see a result in falls because with immobility, you have muscle atrophy. And then if you're not getting nutrition and the protein to help build that muscle mass, you're breaking down more proteins. And so that can cause muscle weakness and contribute to falls. You know, so I look at pretty much everything that we fight with our patients trying to improve, you know, with infections, with pressure injuries, with muscle wasting, you know, in, you know, nutrition could help combat a lot of these. And it's often overlooked as the value that it brings.
Yeah. So let me go through an example of this. In a previous podcast episode, I talked about having a morbidly obese patient, somewhere around 400 pounds, and he had a prolonged hospital stay. And in the back of my head, I was thinking, you know, he's not getting great nutrition. I don't remember the specifics of his nutritious status, but I thought, you know, maybe it'll be good for him to lose some weight while he's here. Can you talk about, you know, the fallacy in that thinking and why, you know, how dangerous it is to think about, you know, weight loss in a hospitalized patient, even if they are morbidly obese?
Yes. And that is so true. And I think, unfortunately, that happens, you know, quite a bit where you look at somebody that is morbidly obese and it's like, well, we don't need to start nutrition. You know, they have lots of weight that they could lose. You know, they have all these fat stores.
Right.
You know, so we don't need to feed them, which is a huge myth. And we should never, you know, not feed our patients regardless of their weight. Because even so, we talked about the gut protection, the gut integrity, and protecting that protective barrier that the gut plays, you know, is one reason. But then we also need that, you know, underlying calories and protein for healing, for decreasing infections, to really help the patients get over this hump, especially in critical illness. You know, and it's not, we are never going to give them enough to gain weight. You know, if you look at the calories, even when we try to reach the goal that the dietitians prescribe, we look at what their recommendations are and what do we need to do for the patient. And even trying to get the patient to their goal, most patients, you know, probably get less than 70% of their goal. So, and that goal is to maintain your current metabolic functions, right? So you are never, well, I shouldn't say never. There might be times where you're getting adequate nutrition, but, you know, a lot of times we're underfeeding our patients. But to think that patient, somebody, just because they're morbidly obese, does not need that essential calories and nutrition for to get over their medical condition is absolutely false. And most of their calories that they have, you know, or the reason they are, you know, they overly obese is because of fat stores. So those fat stores are not going to help with their metabolic processes that we need to optimize while they're in the ICU.
I think it'd be important to mention that when that gentleman lost weight, it was not, he was not losing fat necessarily as much as lean muscle.
Yes.
And thinking long run, you know, if he is losing lean muscle, he's going to be less mobile. And I think that's a great illustration of the point that you brought up about falls and, you know, all the dangers associated with immobility.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And when I think of the things that we can do as nurses, you know, to really improve our patient outcomes, and I think it's things that are often overlooked. You know, we need to get our patients out of bed, mobilize them, you know, very basic, and feed them. So yeah. If we could do those things, we are probably going to improve a lot of our patient outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the different methods of nutrition. So I think, you know, in your career in critical care and trauma, you're doing a lot of like tube feedings, but I was wondering if you could just briefly kind of talk through the differences between like a PO diet, tube feeding, and then PN or TPN.
And I don't think I need to talk too much about PO diets, right? So taking food by mouth, as I think everybody's very well aware of that. We all do that, you know, multiple times a day. However, I do want to just a little sidetrack here is to think about, even though you think your patient is alert and oriented and taking their oral diet, you know, we still have to focus on how much are they actually taking in and do they need additional supplementation, you know, with oral nutrition supplements or protein shakes, that type of thing, in order to meet their calories. Because oftentimes, you know, we might see, and if we're not really paying attention, or, you know, the nurse's aides or the techs are the ones taking the tray and they didn't mark down how much they ate, you know, sometimes that slides by, and we've seen patients lose, you know, quite a bit of weight just, and we thought they were eating fine. And just kind of drive home that point with our recent pandemic with COVID, you know, we found a lot of our COVID patients were not eating adequately because they didn't have taste or smell. They were short of breath. They were fatigued. They had nausea, you know, so all of those contributed to them not eating as much. And we should have been intervening sooner in some cases that we've identified. If a patient cannot take oral diet, and obviously our patients in the ICU on ventilators, and they're not going to take nutrition, you know, so those are the ones that we are going to do enteral nutrition or feeding, you know, through their NG, OG, you know, or post-pyloric tube. And what we want to make sure, you know, and of course with our dietitian partners, is what is the formulas that they are getting. So a lot of patients need higher caloric formulas, you know, our trauma patients, our burn patients, you know, they really need a lot more calories than even our, not that an ICU patient is normal, but than our normal ICU patients, you know, they need more protein. A lot of times we're giving not just in the formula with protein, but additional protein, because some of these, probably most of the formulas don't have enough protein or don't have enough calories, you know, and in order to get them all that they would need.
So that's why you would do add protein on top of whatever rate the tube feeding has been given.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes a lot of the ICU patients are on propofol, so with lipids, and they're getting a lot of calories from that, but not a lot of protein. You know, so that's another reason why they might give supplemental protein. But even with enteral nutrition, there are some patients, and that's absolutely so, you know, we want oral intake, and if not, then we want enteral nutrition. And that there are some patients that are contraindicated for that as well. And then we would need to go to total parenteral nutrition, you know, so having your TPN bags or lipid bags, you know, and feeding them basically vascularly, right?
Kind of fascinates me to think that you can just kind of dump nutrition into your vasculature. What happens to the gut when a patient is on TPN?
So the same things that we had talked about earlier, you know, you can have atrophy of the villi, you can have all the mucosal integrity, you know, that would happen, same thing. So what we're seeing a lot now is potentially kind of doing supplemental parenteral nutrition if they need more calories, and then giving lower dose enteral nutrition. There's been some research that's been coming out recently. And, you know, we've always thought, and, you know, I don't think parenteral nutrition should ever be the first line unless your patient has short gut syndrome, or, you know, they've had a major bowel obstruction or bowel surgery. You know, obviously we're not going to feed them. So there are those instances where we have to rely on parenteral nutrition. But because we are giving all these calories, I mean, they're usually high glucose, you know, high fat, you know, so our triglycerides might go up, we might see hyperglycemia. There's been, you know, research in the past. I think we're better at maintaining central lines now than we were before, because if you need a central line, you obviously have that increased risk for infection, you know, and then, you know, layer on that, we're not using our gut, so our immune function may be impaired as well. And then with all the glucose, we're going to have hyperglycemia, which contributes to infection, right? So there's all of these things at play that might not be very beneficial to our patients. Now, there are times that it's absolutely essential, and that's what we need to do. And then, you know, lately there has been some research, like I said, that if we are feeding enteral nutrition and we can't give them what they need, maybe some supplemental parenteral nutrition might be indicated.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never seen that, like a patient on simultaneous parenteral feeding and TPN.
Yeah. And I will tell you, we don't do that in our facility. That's just some of the research that has been coming out lately. So that it might be a benefit, but I honestly have not done that.
Yeah. I mean, who would that be indicated for? Are you talking about like a trauma patient or a burn patient? Yeah. Calorie?
A lot or several studies that I've read recently were with COVID patients, and a push that, you know, now we in my facility, we use a lot of post-pyloric small bowel tubes. So we can usually get the patient up to their feeding goal pretty rapidly without worrying about the gastroparesis or, you know, feeding intolerance. But if you're feeding just gastrically and they're having feeding intolerance and you're not able to feed them to goal nutrition, that's when, you know, some of the recommendations were maybe you need to go to some supplemental parenteral nutrition as well.
Are you studying for the CCRN or the PCCN? These are tough exams. I know, as I recently studied for the PCCN myself. I was luckily able to pass the exam by studying with Nicole Kupchick's online self-paced review courses, as well as her book of practice questions. I can't recommend these resources enough, and if you want to up your nursing career, check out her website, NicoleKupchickConsulting.com, and use the promo code UPMYGAME20 to get 20% off all of her products.
Let's talk about the different methods of establishing this enteral feeding. And I'll just say at my hospital now, any patient who requires tube feeding is going to get a post-pyloric tube place. But that wasn't the case at my previous hospital. And I was just wondering if you could kind of walk through the different methods of establishing this tube feeding and, you know, the kind of the risks and benefits of each one.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is definitely a passion of mine.
Yeah.
I've gotten interested in nutrition a lot is based on how do we get that enteral access.
Right. And this is a very nursing heavy part of the discussion here. So I think this is great.
Absolutely. And I think this is where nurses are essential to be looking at what tubes their patient has, what do we need, what do we have available. And if you don't have a good mechanism available at your institution, to advocate to get something. And so one of the main reasons I say that is the biggest risk of any type of tube placement, whether it's the large bore OG, NG, you know, that we use for sump, stomach decompression, as well as the small bore feeding tubes, is the risk for placing it into the lung, having pneumothorax, and then the risk of death. And we know the reported percentage of blind placements with any of those tubes is 2-3%, you know, which if you look at the statistics of how many tubes are placed in the United States, you know, that's, you know, upwards to almost 10,000 people that would have a tube in their lung, which is unacceptable. Wow. So, you know, and for nurses, you know, now again, being an older nurse, we never had like some newer technologies that we would use. And so we would put the tube in the water and see if it bubbles, or you wait for the patient to cough, which are, and I'm not saying do that. This is an absolute no-no because, you know, our patients in the ICU, if they're on the ventilator, they're sedated, they might be paralyzed. You know, we're not going to know if it's going into the lung. And so you really want some mechanism to visualize that. So I'm going to back up. So I would say across the country, even across the world, it's probably most common to start with gastric feedings. And then if the patient has signs of intolerance, to advance to post-pyloric feedings or start prokinetic agents. And I think the key why most people would not advance to post-pyloric feedings is how the tubes get placed at the bedside. You know, so that's where I think nurses can have a huge impact in advocating for, you know, and I won't go into any of the devices. There's a lot of different technology available now for placing feeding tubes at the bedside, driven by nurses. A lot of times dietitians are starting to place tubes as well. But the most important thing is that you can visualize and see where that tube is going as you are placing it. Because if it's going into the lung, you want to recognize that and pull it back and then reinsert. And the problem with x-rays are the gold standard. So any tube that you place needs to have an x-ray confirmation. But the problem with that is that's after the fact. So I could have a tube in the lung and then I need to order my x-ray, and maybe x-ray is backed up and they haven't gotten up there and they haven't done the x-ray, and now this patient has already had damage to their lungs. So I'm a huge advocate for, you know, we need some way to visualize placement. And if not, if you don't have some way to visualize, using CO2 confirmation as you are inserting, because that shows if the tube is going into the lung, if you get CO2 on these devices. So somehow, you know, really focusing on the safety of the patient while we are inserting tubes.
I think it's helpful to kind of point out the fact that we're talking about two different kinds of tubes here. Right. That I think when in my experience blindly placing tubes, they were these large bore sump pumps that were mainly for gastric decompression. You know, these are your small bowel obstruction patients who are on like low continuous suction, versus the small bore, which is just with the intention of food and medicine going down, yeah. Nothing coming back up.
We have a device for feeding tube placements. So for the small bore feeding tubes, for large bore, I will tell you, there's some blind placement. Those don't go as easily into the lung, and that's really not a scientifically based statement, because they do go in the lung, you know, and they also, of course, you know, we want to be very careful with basal or skull fractures or nasal fractures. There have been tubes that have gone into the brain, you know, and there are these, you know, unbelievable pictures of CAT scans because somebody took a tube and they had a basal or skull fracture and it literally went into the brain. You know, but our greatest risk, of course, is the in the lung and the pneumothorax. So best practice is to use some type of device, you know, so there's CO2 detectors or some type of visual aid. If you don't have that, then, and across the board, you still need to get radiographic verification before you ever feed somebody or give them medications down that tube. So a lot of times, like in the emergency department or in trauma patients, you know, they're resuscitating, they're going to put this large bore tube down, but they're only putting it to suction, right? And you can tell if you start getting aspirate back. So there are some safety mechanisms there. It's still not the best practice, but you know, it is what it is. But for a small bore feeding tube insertion, I don't think any of them should be blind anymore. You need to have some type of CO2 or visualization device.
Can you describe the CO2 detection?
Yeah. So if you think about, most people are familiar with the ET tube. So when you intubate somebody and you have a little CO2 detector that you put on the end, and it turns, and I know I'm going to get this wrong, yellow to purple. Or purple to yellow, you can edit out the one. So with the color change, when you have CO2 present, as when you're placing an endotracheal tube, you want to see that there are CO2, right? Because that's your lungs and we want that going into the airway. But when we're placing a tube, you know, we don't want to see that CO2. So the presence of CO2 and that color change would indicate your tube is going into the lung and you need to pull it back.
Got it. We talked about blind insertion versus visually guided. It's hard to not talk about brand names here a little bit, because I think that's the only way I really know, like, that call these devices. But can you just describe to a nurse maybe who hasn't seen this before, like what these visual guided insertions look like?
Yeah. So there are probably three that are the most popular. One has a camera on the end of the tube. Oh. So you can visually see, you know, if you're going into the airway or, you know, and then the esophagus. Now you have to be trained to interpret that and know, you know, where it's going.
The nurse do that?
They can. Okay. They can. If with training. with training. And I do want to say this is absolutely essential. So the camera device, and then there's two electromagnetic placement devices.
Mm-hmm. These are the ones I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. And those have a little bit different technology, but essentially what you're able to do is this electromagnetic device, and then there's a receiver, transmitter, and then it picks up on a screen, you know, that you can see that the tracing of the tube, it's either going straight or it might angle off to the right or the left. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want that angle off to the right or the left, because then you're going in the lung. You know, you want to see straight. And then there's additional techniques, you know, so with those tubes, really for placing post-pyloric. So you get into the stomach, and then, you know, you can see based on the tracing and the patient's anatomy, you know, that it goes through the stomach and then into the small intestine, which is ideally where, you know, we want to be, especially if you've tried gastric feedings and they've had enteral feeding intolerance, you know, and maybe prokinetic agents did or didn't work. We don't even try prokinetic agents at my facility. We just go to a post-pyloric tube. So because we have a great technique, we have nurses that are well-trained, you know, and so we put those tubes in at the bedside and, you know, pretty early trigger to go ahead and do that. I think it all comes down to feasibility and what equipment, what resources you have in your facility.
Yeah. What are the benefits of post-pyloric versus gastric?
I'm a big fan of post-pyloric, and for the main reason is, and we have a good technique, so we can get our tubes in pretty fast. We can get the patient up to their goal feedings, you know, pretty quickly. We don't have to worry about all the problems with enteral feeding intolerance and our patients vomiting. You know, I think, you know, then when we prone our patients, you know, you don't have to, and really you don't have to shut off feedings anyway, but there's no problem with that. You know, some people actually are starting to feed their patients up to the time of going to surgery because it's post-pyloric. So you don't have the risk of the regurgitation as you do with stomach. The biggest thing that I have seen is that we can get our patients to their goal rate faster without having any problems.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but a patient can still vomit if they're on a post-pyloric feeding.
So you've bypassed the pylorus, right? So you shouldn't have the regurgitation of the feedings, but you will still have your stomach secretions, you know, right, and your gastric acid secretions that you could still potentially have some intolerance in vomiting that. Depending on the severity of the patient, you might see that we have a sump tube in and we're decompressing the stomach, as well as feeding them post-pyloric to help prevent some of those.
Okay. I know we produce a lot of gastric secretions a day, and like upwards of a liter, I once heard.
Yeah, I think it's like 200 an hour of gastric or salivary secretions, you know, so what you have in your GI system. So
200 an hour.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. I didn't realize it was that much. I've had a patient who had a post-pyloric tube and he still continued to regurgitate. And I remember like kind of shaking my head in the doctor's, it can happen. It still happens. Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not like a magic bullet that will solve all of these problems.
Right. Yeah. And so that really comes into play too, when, I don't know if we want to get into this, but gastric residual volumes and checking for gastric residual volumes. And it's kind of that fallacy that you need to shut your feedings off. And so that's some of the information. So we're producing all these secretions and, you know, from stomach acid and salivary secretions, you know, that you have that in your stomach anyway. So sometimes when you're checking that gastric residual volume and you're stopping for 250 makes no sense because you're producing, you know, all of this within our body already.
Yeah. Let's talk about gastric residual volume. This is something that I think we are taught, or at least I was taught to check in nursing school. And it was always kind of a gray area in practice, like, you know, at what point do you hold tube feeding? Like, what gastric residual is acceptable? What is not? You know, when do you contact the doctor? Like, how important is gastric residual?
So it's really interesting time, because if you look at a lot of the nutrition guidelines, they don't recommend that we routinely check gastric residual volumes any longer. And so the rationale behind that is because people were stopping the feedings just kind of arbitrarily. And this is something I always like to do whenever I'm talking about nutrition is ask, you know, what volume do you stop? And you'll see some people will say 250, 300. You know, I always like two times the rate that you're, you know, 500. And it's all across the board. Like there's really never been a great standard for this. The other problem with gastric residual volumes is it can be different based on the patient position, based on where the tube is placed. You know, perhaps the tip of your NG tube is more at the anterior portion of the stomach and you have all these feeding and secretions at the posterior portion of the stomach, you know, or if the patient's on their right side and the tube is up above it, you're not getting accurate volumes for the most part. And there has been some research to show that. So what most guidelines have gone to is don't check it, because the research that shows when you don't check it, we don't have any greater volume of aspiration, any greater prevalence of aspiration or incidence. And then the people aren't stopping feedings arbitrarily. So the patients are meeting their goal faster. We're getting the calories, we're getting the proteins in. You know, why not checking gastric residual volumes? Now, there are a lot of people that it's hard to break those old habits. Mm-hmm. But so the American Society of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition and the Society of Critical Care Medicine guidelines, so they say do not check gastric residual volume. But if you do, then don't hold feedings unless it's above 500. And so, you know, let's go to that higher end, you know, so that we're not just arbitrarily stopping feedings. And so I think that is good practice. And there's some controversy of, you know, maybe we should check it in our prone patients, you know, that might be at a higher risk for aspiration, you know, or so there might be, you know, some indications that the nurse might want to, but to do this across the board is not indicated. It's not based on research. And what we have found is when we're not looking at that, people don't stop feedings and that we can reach goal and feed our patients more adequately in a more timely manner.
Do you think it would also contribute to clogging of the device too?
Yes, absolutely it can. And that has been shown. And the other thing I want to put out there, and I hope everybody is aware, but maybe not. So, you know, we do want to educate everybody, is if you have a small bore feeding tube, and especially if a small bore feeding tube in the intestines, you should never check gastric residual volumes on that. You should not check any residual volumes because those tubes are so small and pliable and you're just going to collapse them. And then you're right. Anytime that you're pulling back all the secretions into the tube, you're going to be more prone for clotting.
Yeah.
Not clotting, yeah. Clogging.
Clogging, yeah. Clogging. Same concept. So let's keep on dispelling some tube feeding myths here.
I love this one too. So the interesting from the guidelines, and a lot of people aren't aware, you know, we have a lot of people, nurses, physicians, you know, that really hold on to these traditional practices, right? And so if you think of any type of surgery and the surgeons are like, well, we can't start feedings, don't start eating until you have bowel sounds or until you pass gas. So we've held on to this thought that we can't start feedings until these things happen, right? And so the really interesting thing about bowel sounds is that, you know, I just always love talking about this particular myth because, mm-hmm. you know, if you ask people if they've listened to bowel sounds, it's like, oh yeah, sure. You know, but as a nurse, you know, you usually put your stethoscope in each quadrant, you know, maybe for a few seconds. It's like, okay, yeah, no bowel sounds. But to adequately assess for bowel sounds, you need to listen in each quadrant for 5 minutes. And so if you think about that, that's a 20-minute abdominal assessment. And I'm pretty confident not everybody is doing that. The other caveat with that is, and there's been studies on this as well, that they've looked at the QC or, you know, how physicians and nurses assess bowel sounds, and it's totally inaccurate. So there's really no purpose to it. And I'm pretty sure, you know, I will never sit here and say, do a 20-minute auscultation for your bowel sounds. But the other thing that I think we forget is just by feeding into the gut, we are going to stimulate that peristaltic activity. And we're going to stimulate the stomach and the intestines to start working. You know, so we just need to get it started. You know, we don't need to wait for bowel sounds or flatus. You know, we just need to start the feedings.
Yeah. I like when you talked about this during this session. That was a big aha moment for me because I listen to bowel sounds probably about 5 seconds for each quadrant. If I hear them, then I'll move on to the next quadrant, listen for 5 seconds. And then maybe, you know, longer if I can't hear it. But I mean, is there any utility in listening for bowel sounds?
That's a great question. And off the top of my mind, I'm going to say no.
You want to say no, yeah.
Yeah. And there's actually been, and this has been some time, you know, probably at least 10 years ago, there was an article published, you know, trying to advocate that we just drop that, you know, from a nursing standpoint, that, you know, there's no utility, there's no benefit, you know, we should just not do it. Now, there's probably more utility in looking for abdominal distension, you know, and that's a sign for feeding intolerance. But yeah, again, that can be pretty subjective as well.
Yeah, absolutely. How about another myth here, position of the patient? You've talked about proning a bit. What position is contraindicated with feeding?
What position is contraindicated with feedings? I would say none. So one of the myths that, you know, again, this goes way back. And I think, you know, as nurses, we've just held on to it. And you can ask most nurses, you know, if you're as simple as, you know, of course, we try to maintain our head of bed 30 degrees and prevent ventilator associated pneumonia and aspiration and so forth. But when you put your patient's head down to reposition, you know, they've slid down, we want to pull them up in bed or we want to turn them on their side. You know, so when you put your head down, it's a very common practice to turn the feedings off. You know, yes. And I used to do this all the time, you know, and I still see nurses that are like, oh, turn their feedings off. And I'm like, okay, why did we do that? You know, why do we turn the feedings off? So if you think about, just to walk through this for a minute, when you put the head down and pull them up, you know, let's say it takes 5 minutes. But even if your feedings are going at a high of like 60 milliliters an hour, and we put their head down, and for 5 minutes, they would have gotten 5 milliliters, 5 cc's, right? Mm-hmm. So that is not going to cause them to aspirate, you know, and have vomiting just from that, you know, 5 cc's. It's, you know, maybe what's in their stomach, you know, could potentially, but, you know, that's why we also have sphincters in our stomach to protect. But so there's been one study that was completed, and I love this study, and I would love to see it replicate it, where they had a study of 23 or 24 patients, and they used the patient as their own control. So the patient's head was up, they checked for pepsin, so which is a marker of aspiration, and then they put the head down and they checked for pepsin, and that, you know, again, marker of aspiration. And so when they looked at these patients twice, so one with the head up, one with the head down, there was no difference in aspiration and essentially no difference in gastric residual volumes. It doesn't make a difference. And the other aspect of repositioning that is very common with the pandemic the last 2 years is proning, you know, and even before that, we were proning our ARDS patients. But a lot of people think that, oh, we're turning them over, I need to stop the feedings, or, you know, I've heard random, stop the feedings for 30 minutes before you prone, or stop the feedings for an hour before you prone. And it really, again, makes no sense whatsoever. So you can leave the feedings running while you prone your patient, and then certainly leave it running while they are in the prone position. I was talking to someone recently at NTI, and they told me that they always turn their feedings off when they prone. And I was like, and you prone for 16 to 20 hours? Yes. Oh. I'm like, oh my gosh. So your patient's essentially getting no feedings. So that is a total myth. It is not true. And we need to make sure that our patients are getting fed even while they are in the prone position. Now, the only reason I've seen legitimately to stop feedings during proning is because we don't want the tubing to get all wrapped up around the patient, right? So if we're manually pruning and trying to just get tubes out of the way, you know, that might make sense, but there's no need to stop while we are turning or while we are in the prone position.
Yeah. And I would say in practice, what this has looked like for me is if we turn off tube feeding to reposition a patient, to clean them up, we sometimes forget to restart it. And so a patient will go, you know, I don't know, 20 minutes, half hour without tube feeding because we had forgotten to turn it back on after we repositioned them. And there was some education around this at a hospital that I used to work at, that this can contribute to hypoglycemic episodes as well. So yeah, there was a lot of education around, you know, there's no need to pause feeding while you lay your patient down flat. And I also think this is something that is worth sharing with the assistants, the techs who work with you, as they're often, you know, doing this practice of turning off feedings during repositioning.
Yes, absolutely. And that's 100% why we should not do this, you know, is because you forget to turn it back on. And that's one of the things that have been shown to really contribute to inadequate or underfeeding our patients is inadvertently turning feedings off, you know, or, you know, and any time that we reposition them.
Right. And I could see where in like a COVID room, if it's loud, if you're trying to cluster your care as much as possible, that it could be potentially a long pause before you realize that the tube feeding's off and you re-enter the room.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. What about another myth I'd like to address is declogging. And this is such a fascinating topic. Like, you get nurses talking about declogging feeding tubes. Like, everyone has their answer for, you know, what to do and their idea. And I have to admit, like, I'm going to be honest, like, I've tried all sorts of different techniques, from like hot water to Coke, regular Coke. Let's just talk about declogging techniques and what's safe and what's not.
Yeah. And I think that this is always another, you know, favorite topic of mine, because again, it goes back to a lot of traditional practices, you know, and sometimes we just hold on to those, don't we? First of all, I want to say the best strategy is prevention. And so we don't want those clogs to occur in the first place. And the reason we usually see those clogs occurring is because people aren't flushing routinely. They're not flushing, you know, so you really need to flush your tube every 4 hours, you know, with at least 30 milliliters. You need to flush before and after medications, not mixing all your medications into a little slurry, because that can cause some clogging too. And I'm guilty. I used to do that. And then the other thing that we talked about earlier was protein. So some of these protein supplements are very viscous and yes, can contribute to clogging, or they interact with the feedings as well.
So they're sticky. Too.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. So the best strategy is prevention in the first place. But once we do get a clog in the tube, you know, I've seen so many, and nurses still are using it. And I did in the past too, I will admit, but now we know better. When you know better, we do better. You know, Coke, or the other thing is some of the acidic juices, you know, so grape juice or apple juice. Orange juice probably is not, but anything that's acidic, you know, with that acidic pH. But the problem with that is we think, and maybe it's a temporary, you know, that, oh yeah, we got, it's probably not what we used. It's more the pressure than what we actually used. But those acidic type of, or juices or acidic, what am I trying to say?
Like the sodas.
Sodas. Yeah. Anything like that. They actually worsen the occlusion because they cause the proteins in the enteral formula to precipitate within the tube. So you can make it worse by using that. You might get a temporary, but then you're going to have it worse. And I'm not sure how real this is, but I've seen some people say, you know, it could also break down some of the tubes, but I haven't really seen that. But what we really want to do is warm water, you know, 30 to 60 milliliters, and just kind of do that back and forth push and pull pressure. And then there are commercially available products. You talked about Clog Zapper, but you know, what those are is essentially enzymes. a lot of people, we have on our nutritional order set, you know, different enzymatic pancreatic enzyme preparations that we can use to do that. And then the other thing, again, not to get into any names, and I can't think of the name anyway, but there's mechanical devices, you know, where you could actually put this in the tube and it's like a little jackhammer, like a little baby jackhammer, you know, these little small vibrations that break the tube down. So that, you know, just came on the market a few years ago. And that's really interesting too. Now, how well that works compared to the enzymatic preparations, I don't know that there's been research studies done, but I think it goes back to, again, you know, prevention is the best strategy. And then if you do have a clog, stay away from the carbonated beverages or the acidic beverages, you know, and you need to use just warm water or the enzymes.
So before we go, I wanted to talk about advocacy. So what are some things that nurses can do to promote nutrition in their patients? And one item I wanted to talk to you about was a screening tool that we can use on admission. Actually, this is kind of perfect. The other day, I had a dietitian text me at work and say, hey, the screening isn't done from the admission of this patient. Can you please complete it? I was like, oh, good. Someone's actually looking at the data we put in about, you know, for admissions, because sometimes I feel like a lot of this just kind of floats off into space. But yeah, can you talk about some of the screening tools that are out there?
Now, I think where we kind of fail our patients sometimes is not necessarily at that admission. We know it has to be done within 24 hours. That's Joint Commission requirement, you know, and then we get the dietitian consult. But, you know, what happens if that patient's been there a week, you know, or 2 weeks, and, you know, maybe they came in without malnutrition and they developed it, because we know, you know, about 30% of the patients do develop malnutrition while they're in the hospital, which is really sad. You know, so there needs to be some ongoing assessments. Hopefully the dietitians in your facilities will have a standard practice or protocol, you know, where they're looking at everybody, you know, that has been admitted over 5 or 7 days, and so that they're following up on that. But I think that is where, just to get into, you know, your first question of nurse advocacy, is I think the nurses need to be looking at their patients, advocating for early enteral nutrition, making sure the patients have a feeding tube in place and a safe way to place that tube. And if not, you know, be talking to your managers, your leaders, your, you know, if you have clinical nurse specialist, educators, you know, somebody on the units that can help you navigate, you know, that we need to have a better mechanism to place these tubes. But I have seen when nurses understand the importance of nutrition and they are the ones asking that question and it's always top of the mind, you know, that we feed our patients much earlier. And partnering with your dietitian, you know, they should be hopefully rounding, you know, on a daily basis or several times a week with the whole healthcare team. You know, hopefully there's some multidisciplinary rounds going on and that you have that connection and, you know, to partner with them and what can they do from a dietitian standpoint, and then how do the nurses advocate and partner with them, you know, in the ICUs or on the floors, anywhere in the hospital.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think you really got it when you said that when nurses understand the importance of nutrition is when they're going to advocate for it. So I think like that's the most important piece and something that I hope that we've addressed in this episode. Is there anything else you would like to add? I always like to ask my guests, like, what are takeaways? Like, if you want a nurse to come away from this episode with one or two topics to remember, what would they be?
Number one would be what we just talked about as far as, you know, understanding the importance of nutritional support and that it goes far beyond just giving calories and protein, you know, some type of nutrition to our patients, that it actually plays that protective mechanism. And we are, you know, preventing infections, protecting our gut by giving them nutritional support. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much the gut plays in the immune system and how important that is. And so, you know, so it's not just giving calories and protein, but then also we want to make sure that we do feed them adequately as well and give them enough calories and proteins to help in their healing process. But I guess my dream is that nurses would take a more active role in looking at nutritional support and seeing the importance of that and advocating for that for their patients.
Love it. I think my takeaway is that tube feeding, besides instances of bowel obstruction, surgeries, et cetera, that is rarely contraindicated. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter the position of the patient, their bowel sounds, their gastric residual, that there are relatively few instances when you should not be feeding your patients.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great takeaway because a lot of people are not aware of that. And even so, I'm just going to throw in here too, there's always been this myth of pancreatitis patients and we can't feed pancreatitis. They have to rest their bowel.
Yeah.
You know, but there have been systematic reviews that show it's safe to feed patients with pancreatitis. So they're another one that is kind of this myth that we have held on to traditionally, and it's not true. Like you said, there are very few patients that I think we could not feed with enteral nutrition.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jan. I think this is a great discussion on the overall concepts of nutrition and also some great, like, very practical takeaway tips. And I think this is just such a great discussion. And I thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. It's been fun. Thank you.
So I looked up the device that Janice was mentioning that, quote, jackhammers clogged feeding tubes, and it's called Tube Clear. It's essentially a flexible wire that's hooked up to a machine that quickly moves the wire backwards and forwards so as to chip away and really, like Janice said, jackhammer a clog. You can check out a video of it in the show notes, which I recommend. It's pretty cool. Okay, that's it for today. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to claim your free CE credit for this episode by going to VCU Health, whose link is in the show notes. Follow this podcast on Instagram and Facebook at Up My Nursing Game. Until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.